So tonight, I wanted to start out with some words from the 20th century American poet Muriel Rukeyser from a book she wrote called The Life of Poetry, which she wrote in the shell-shocked aftermath of World War II. But I failed to bring it in my little stack. I'm working in the living room these days because that's where the wood stove is. And I've got all these piles of poetry. It's getting hard to walk. and I left that one home. So I will see if I can paraphrase what it was that she... It's the very beginning of the book. It's how she opens the book. And she says something like, in dark times, we need to tap our deepest resources. We need all the resources we can get, and poetry being one of them, those deep sources that poetry taps, we need. And last week I talked about or quoted her a little bit about what we're afraid of in poetry, and linked that to what's a little scary about our Zen practice sometimes, because it means letting go. It means letting go of our defenses and our habitual frames and habits, and being willing to be changed, being willing to be opened, to have heart and mind opened, turned. We talked about the way poetry, that the best of poetry turns us, opens us. Emily Dickinson said something about how it lifts off the top of your head. So Rukeyser opens her book in that way, and then she says that turning of poetry, you know, sort of, I'm really paraphrasing here, but on a global scale, that turning is so infinitesimal that it's not even noticeable, but it's there. And that resonated in terms of our practice as well. You know, sometimes we, you know, the turning is very small, subtle sometimes. Sometimes it's dramatic, but then we get all excited and get disappointed when it doesn't stay, right? So, what we're finding last week and again this week are kind of parallel aspects to the practice of poetry and the practice of Zen, or Buddhist practice. Rukeyser goes on to tell a story about leaving Europe at the outset of the war on a small boat loaded 5 times beyond its capacity, filled with refugees. So this is not news, is it? How long ago was that now? And people stood on the deck quietly talking in the night. And a man kind of interjected and said something like, "Where is the place for poetry in all this?" And her book was her answer to that question. Others have asked and tried to answer that question as well, and maybe in these few weeks we're going to spend, there are another way of asking and answering that question in the context of our practice. The end of World War II, the German philosopher Theodor Adorno, who is of mixed Jewish and Italian heritage, if you wonder about that name, and he fled Germany. After World War II, he said, "After the Holocaust, there can be no poetry." It's quite a famous line. There are events that shock us into silence. And yet, there is something irrepressible in that human urge to speak out, to sing out. Bertolt Brecht, the German poet and playwright, wrote words that, though they predated Adorno's words, serve as a reply. He wrote, "In dark times, will there also be singing?" Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. Brecht left Nazi Germany in 1933, spent several years living in Scandinavian countries, several more in the United States, where he was blacklisted during the Cold War anti-communist paranoia, and then moved back to Europe for the last 8 years of his life. Are we living dark times now? Feels like it, doesn't it? Times. Maybe no darker than ever before. But certainly there are many parts of the world where the chilly winds of fear and paranoia are sweeping through. And at the same time, voices are rising to sing about it. So what is the place, where is the place of poetry in all this? And where is the place for sitting in silence, as we do, you know, paying attention to body and mind? Don't these practices seem useless in response to the urgent calls for action that we hear? Both poetry and Zen meditation have been accused of being useless, both in the literal sense and the tongue-in-cheek sense. Poetry as useless in a utilitarian, action-oriented society, not valued and supported, disdained. You know, poets are kind of wusses, aren't they? In certain sectors. Meditation, disdained as self-absorbed navel-gazing, right? I knew a doctor once who was just so, you know, really, disdainful of people who are navel-gazers. On the other hand, both have been valued just because they are non-utilitarian. Suzuki Shunryu Roshi called Zen good for nothing when he warned in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, against practicing with a gaining mind, you know, to get enlightenment. Bypassing the bright awareness that is available to us in each moment. And poetry has claimed a zone of freedom from taboos, agendas, and ideologies. Not serving any of those, right? For both the freedom of the mind to exercise flexibility. Oh, for both our practice in Zen and poetry, the freedom of the mind to exercise flexibility, even playfulness, is key. The verse, what I think of as the first Dharma talk I ever heard, was at a mountain temple in Japan where a friend, and I hadn't been there long at all, I'd just been in Japan a few months, and a Japanese friend invited Michael and me to his tea ceremony lesson with this Zen abbot in the temple on the mountainside. So we went, and the abbot was, I thought tea ceremony was kind of a uptight thing, kind of prissy, that Japanese young women did to become more marriageable. I wasn't interested. But this abbot was so warm and relaxed and welcoming and put us at ease in a way that I think really expressed the true heart of tea ceremony. And as part of tea ceremony, usually the host talks a little bit about the utensils, their history, and he'll talk about the scroll on the wall. And the scroll is usually hung in something called a tokonoma, which if you've seen a typical Japanese room is a kind of alcove set aside. And there's usually a flower arrangement and a scroll, maybe a sculpture. And he explained the character on the scroll that day was the character for play. He said, the tokonoma is a useless space. It's not a functional space in the Japanese room. He says, zazen is like that. It's not serving any, it's not functional. It's an open space. And play is non-utilitarian as well, or not valued in a utilitarian society. But play, he said, is what we do in zazen and in our lives when we let go of our fixed habit patterns and behavior. We play, and you find this in the koan literature, these old Zen masters playing in the field of awareness, of the playing with the relative and the absolute, you know, the everyday and the ultimate. So what he was saying is that we need that open space in our lives to cultivate freedom. I've always loved the character for play ever since that. Sometimes in Zen practice and poetry practice, we deliberately take up restrictions, forms, as an aid to letting go into the freedom that lies within the space of that form. And sometimes we're surprised by the grace and beauty we find there. In both poetry and Buddhist and Zen communities, there has been for years an internal debate about the question of political or social engagement, or we should add environmental engagement these days as well, with strong opinions on both sides. You know, should poetry be engaged? Should Buddhist practice be engaged? Or should it be somehow separate from such worldly issues and concerns? Not contaminated by adherence to doctrines or ideologies. On the other side, poetry or Buddhist practice that focuses only on the inner world of heart and mind without engaging with the sufferings and passions of the world becomes dry, cut off in some way. The Polish poet, does anybody know Polish? Okay, so how do you pronounce C-Z-E-S-L-A-W?
Czesław.
Oh, good, that's how I would say it. I was hoping. And M-I-L-O-S-Z.
Milosz. Oh.
Yay. So Czesław Milosz, an eminent Polish poet, in a poem called Dedication, which we'll read in a few minutes, asks, what is poetry which does not save nations or people? We could ask likewise, what is Zen practice that does not save all beings? Yet, saving beings and nations does not mean poetry is propaganda or screed or rant. As we discussed last week, the best poetry opens our hearts and minds, transforms us in some way. Even in the 17 syllables of a haiku, there needs to be a turning, an opening beyond the small self. And in that way, beings are saved, nations are saved. Though the turning may be so infinitesimal as not to be discernible. War, human cruelty, and injustice on the personal, societal, and global levels are included in good poetry. because that's the context of our human condition. As our beauty, kindness, courage, and the absurd. All are included in good poetry, as all are included in our practice. Nothing is excluded. But what is asked of poetry changes with time and place and culture. The ancient Chinese poets, influenced by Chan and Taoist thought, often included war, social chaos, and poverty in their poems. They traveled, observed, and responded to what they saw. But more recently, during the heyday of the communist regime, during the Cultural Revolution, the state imposed upon poets to produce propaganda in their poetry. So in response, a group of poets arose who used often kind of obscure imagery and modernist techniques. They were dubbed the Misty Poets. For them to write about personal feelings and an inner life was transgressive, dissident, risking imprisonment. They flourished from about 1979, the Beijing Spring, to the student uprisings in 1989. And after the Tiananmen Square massacre, many of them went into exile. One of those, perhaps the most famous, is Bei Dao, who lived and taught all over Europe and the United States until he was allowed to go back to China in 2006. I believe he's in Hong Kong now. And I thought we'd read his poem called The Answer, which was the title poem of his first collection in 1976. It can help to read poems, these poems of engagement, with a sense of their historical and social context, but the best of them resonate beyond their specific circumstances. So I want to kind of invite you to see how the poems tonight, I've chosen four again, like last week, how they resonate for you. So The Answer. Debasement is the password of the base. Nobility, the epitaph of the noble. See how the gilded sky is covered with the drifting, twisted shadows of the dead. The ice age is over now. Why is there ice everywhere? The Cape of Good Hope has been discovered. Why do 1,000 sails contest the Dead Sea? I came into this world bringing only paper, rope, a shadow, to proclaim before the judgment the voice that has been judged. Let me tell you, world, I do not believe. If 1,000 challengers lie beneath your feet, count me as number 1,001. I don't believe the sky is blue. I don't believe in thunder's echoes. I don't believe that dreams are false. I don't believe that death has no revenge. If the sea is destined to breach the dikes, let all the brackish water pour into my heart. If the land is destined to rise, let humanity choose a peak for existence again. A new conjunction and glimmering stars adorn the unobstructed sky now. They are the pictographs from 5,000 years. They are the watchful eyes of future generations. So it helps a little to imagine him writing that, you know, in the wake of the Cultural Revolution. And yet perhaps it still resonates. We're not going to analyze these poems. I really want you to just kind of receive them and see what, yeah, what opens or shifts for you as you read each poem. Let's go back to Czesław Miłosz and his poem Dedication. I think that should be on the reverse of this one or on a separate page for some of you. This is from his 1945, so just post-war, book titled Rescue, after he had witnessed the Warsaw Ghetto gutted and his city burned. You whom I could not save, listen to me. Try to understand this simple speech, as I would be ashamed of another. I swear there is in me no wizardry of words. I speak to you with silence like a cloud or a tree. What strengthened me for you was lethal. You mixed up farewell to an epoch with the beginning of a new one. Inspiration of hatred with lyrical beauty. Blind force with accomplished shape. Here is a valley of shallow Polish rivers and an immense bridge going into white fog. Here is a broken city, and the wind throws the screams of gulls on your grave when I am talking with you. What is poetry which does not save nations or people? A connivance with official lies. A song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment. Readings for sophomore girls. That I wanted good poetry without knowing it. That I discovered late its salutary aim. In this and only this I find salvation. They used to pour millet on graves or poppy seeds to feed the dead who would come disguised as birds. I put this book here for you, who once lived, so that you should visit us no more. If, as our Bodhisattva vows say, we are to vow to save all beings, we must be able to see clearly the karmic forces at work that, despite our efforts and our most ardent wishes, lead to the loss of those we cannot save. And then we rededicate our vows. We rededicate our lives. Milosz's poem reminds me of a passage from a long poem called Natural Resources, from the great American poet Adrienne Rich. Her closing lines, it's a long poem, her closing lines are, "My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those who age after age, perversely, with no extraordinary power, reconstitute the world." So our poems are not likely to save those we wish to save. And from that very knowledge, we write what has been called the poetry of witness, poetry that does not turn away. If we strain too hard to get a message across, to persuade, we risk pushing our readers away with a kind of holier-than-thou polemic diatribe. Kind of like our Zen practice. If we strain too hard with an agenda for our lives or getting enlightened by the time we're, say, 35, there's a pushback from our conditioned mind. Right? We've all felt it, that pushback. The Zen koans are full of references to this. You know, if you try too hard to go one way, you're automatically going the wrong way, the opposite way. Probably the most famous one is this one. Jiajiao asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." Or no, everyday mind. Let's say everyday mind. Jiajiao asked, "Should I try to direct myself toward it?" Nanchuan said, "If you try to direct yourself toward it, you betray your own practice." Jiajiao asked, "How can I know the way if I don't direct myself?" Nanchuan said, "The way is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine way, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space." Nanchuan is saying that if we cling to rigid ideas, to knowing, we end up deluded. We miss some aspect of multifaceted reality. We're only looking in one direction. But if we retreat or cling to not knowing, to what's called emptiness, the impermanence and contingency of everything, we can get stuck in a kind of blankness. As this translation says, blankness. We're paralyzed, unable to speak and respond to the everyday world around us. So I think in poetry too, we dance on this sword's edge. Between the relative and the absolute, between clinging grabbing onto knowledge of the particulars, and retreating into emptiness. So I think that's where that space of play, that non-utilitarian space of our practice, of an alive, vivid meditation practice, and an alive, vivid poetry practice, is a place that opens into the world, where there's freedom and surprising power. So poets aren't the ones who write executive orders or pass legislation. But the great poet Shelley may have been right when he wrote, "Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world." He wrote in 1821, so almost 200 years ago, he wrote an essay called A Defense of Poetry. And he said, "Poetry awakens and enlarges the mind itself by rendering it the receptacle of 1,000 unapprehended combinations of thought. Poetry lifts the veil from the hidden beauty of the world." I'm going to read next a short prose poem. Whoops, where is it? This one, it looks like a paragraph. This is by a New Hampshire poet named Marie Harris, and she submitted this to a website called Poets Against the War, which was established in the few months leading up to the second Gulf War against Iraq, as George W. Bush was getting ready to launch that war. And poets and lots of ordinary people submitted poems to this website. "Sometimes the wider world can only be apprehended obliquely. Snakes are always all of a sudden, no matter where I encounter them. These two were baking under a sheet of black plastic that covered the old bales of mulch hay I needed for the onion row. A garter. Imagine it wound in delicate coils about a stockinged thigh. And another I can't name. Silver-white core emblazoned along its length with brown ovals etched in delicate black. Exposed and surprised by light, uncoiling, they tongue the bright air. Spiders hurry away carrying bulging white sacks. Ants rearrange their ranks. There has been a profound disturbance. Each small movement occasions an intricate series of counter-movements. I couldn't have predicted, for instance, the thousands of reactions to my shadow. So that was her submission to a website against war. She never mentions war at all. Jane Hirschfield, the American poet, says, "Poems do not need to reverse grief or to undo or recast history to do their work of moving and change. They're in times when even the thought of solution insults the actual and irreversible truths of a life. Yet acknowledgement of what is, agreement to what is, are companions enough to alter us inside the unsolvable hour." So again, the poetry of witness, the poetry of what is. Here's her poem that she submitted to the website. Jane Hirschfield's. She wrote it on September 15th, 2001. That would have been 4 days after 9/11. "The dead do not want us dead. Such petty errors are left for the living. Nor do they want our mourning, no gift to them, not rage, not weeping. Return one of them, any one of them, to the earth, and look. Such foolish skipping, such telling of bad jokes, such feasting, even a cucumber, even a single anise seed. Feasting." In that essay that Shelley wrote nearly 200 years ago, he said, "The cultivation of poetry is never more to be desired than at periods when, from an excess of the selfish and calculating principle, the accumulation of the materials of external life exceed the quantity of the power of assimilating them into the internal laws of human nature." That's a long sentence, but here he says it more briefly. He says, "The body has then become too unwieldy for that which animates it." What an accurate description of our times. The body of humanity has become too unwieldy for that which animates it. So we need the cultivation of poetry. We need the cultivation of our practice more than ever. In dark times, separation, isolation, and immobility cannot help. Oh, this is Jane Hirschfield again. "Strength and will alone cannot help. What restores the capacity for humanness is the realignment that comes with finding ourselves simply, decently moved. For this, we need the connection forged by poetry's singing. Words that live on a human voice heard by others." The poetry singing doesn't have to be highly sophisticated or intellectual. It can be simple, heartfelt, straightforward. And when it comes from the particular flavor of a poet's direct experience, it has the power to move us. So if you are moved to write some poems, Please don't be intimidated by the great ones. Isaac Dinesen, I don't think she wrote much poetry. She wrote stories and about her life. But she said, write a little every day without hope, without despair. So if you are inclined to take up poetry practice, please do that. Write a little every day without hope, without despair. Just like you sit down and take your posture in Zazen. So, thank you all for coming.